Thank you for listening to Classical U's podcast, for following us with our courses, training teachers, parents, school leaders on classicalu.com. On the podcast, we interview guests that are recording with us, leaders and authors that we're in conversation with related to how to run a great classroom, how to deliver the liberal arts, great books, classical languages to your students. We also have a webinar series, live learning events, that is in collaboration with Scholae Academy and Scholae Communities. Encourage you to watch for those as well. Those are monthly, and we're delighted to have you. Thank you. It's great to be interviewing you, Dr. Graves, and we've met in person one time, and I've been reading some of your work, your book on Nanny Helen Burroughs, and eager to engage with you on some of what I've heard you lecture on and read in your works. And you are an executive leader, a professor, an author, and a lot of expertise and background and experience in education, educational programming, and education history. And my questions today are going to focus on education history for the Classical U podcast and our audience of teachers and leaders and homeschool parents, a wide variety of folks listening in to the Classical U podcast. So thank you very much for giving us your time and look forward to talking.
Absolutely. Thank you.
So your book, published with University of Notre Dame, on Nanny Helen Burroughs, a documentary portrait of an early civil rights pioneer. She was an educator. What are some of the top challenges that you would hope for teachers to take away from her life and work as an educator herself?
Sure, absolutely. You know, Nanny Helen Burroughs was one of the most prodigiously gifted educators, thinkers, philosophers, intellectuals of her time. In fact, she was a mentor to folks like Martin Luther King Jr. She was friends with Mary McLeod Bethune and Carter G. Woodson. So she was deeply invested in both the educational world and government, politics, etc. But really, in terms of challenges that educators can take from Nanny Helen Burroughs's example, is really what it means to invest in young people as people, not as widgets, if you will, what it means to cultivate young people, but also empowering people, particularly young people, to understand and to embrace their heritage. Also, I think Nanny Helen Burroughs is really invested in providing a holistic education. So in case your listeners may not be familiar with Nanny Helen Burroughs, she was born in the African-American woman born in the 1870s in Virginia, and she founded the National Training, among other organizations. She founded, you know, dozens of other organizations, but she's primarily remembered for the National Training School for Women and Girls, which focused on both industrial and liberal arts education. School opened in 1909. And one of the key tenets, when you look at the curriculum of the school, was around the head, the heart, and the hand. So she believed in educating students so that they could be thinkers, so that they could function for themselves in society. She believed that young people ought to be able to lead from the heart. So she was really invested in the moral aspects of educational development. And then also the hand. She believed that young people needed to have a talent or a skill that they could use to not only empower themselves, but to empower their communities. I think another lesson is that we can gather from Burroughs is around how we cultivate students to be contributors to a community and not merely extractors. And so Dr. Burroughs was particularly invested, particularly you have to reflect on the time in which she's leading. This is the early, the late 19th, early 20th century, where opportunities for African Americans are particularly narrow, and more especially so for Black women. So I think there's a host of examples and challenges that we can take from Dr. Burroughs' example.
Yeah, thank you. There is a lot there to unpack. You use the word the term widget in kind of contrast to the whole human person. You know, with head, heart, and hands. We have a course on Classical U about common arts tradition of education. You know, and that use of the hands and the crafts and using our our embodied selves as one part of the whole person. I'm resonating with a lot of what you said right out of the gate. I'm wondering about the larger education history context that she's working in. You've mentioned, you know, the issues with education access for African Americans, obviously not long after, you know, Reconstruction and even slavery. But so that's a critical part of it. But even more broadly than that, you know, the whole nation, United States, in our own education history, was going through some significant transitions at that time as various new ideas were being tried. You use the term widget. I've heard you in a previous lecture use the factory model of education phrase. Is that something that she herself would be aware of and responding to in any way? You know, what kind of changes were taking place? How would she have articulated what was good and what was bad about the changing landscape and educational approaches?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think, you know, when you think about what Burroughs understood about the larger American social structure in which she operated, we can really learn a lot. Of course, as I mentioned earlier, she's operating in an environment where the opportunities for African American are restricted. So she saw education as making an intervention in the educational world of Black folks, if you will. And she wanted to develop an institution where Black women could flourish by virtue of not only their grit, but their genius. Grit and labor is something that was endemic to the African-American experience during the period of enslavement. And so what Dr. Burroughs understood is that the opportunities for Black women coming out of enslavement are going to be particularly restricted. So how do I cultivate an army, if you will, of individuals who are not seen as menial laborers, but an army of people that are seen as skilled artisans, if you will. When you talk about the kind of broader educational landscape, she really was interested in making an intervention. Also, during this particular time in history, particularly you look at African-American educational history, you have this debate between industrial education and liberal arts education, and what is the most appropriate form of education for the race. And so listeners may be familiar with the kind of W.E.B. Du Bois versus Booker T. Washington debate, if you will. But Burroughs did not choose between either of those particular philosophies. What you see in her school is an integration of those philosophies, if you will. So her school emphasized both industrial education or vocational education, ensuring that young people had a skill. And that was directly connected to her desire to develop entrepreneurs for the African American community. But she also saw the necessity of having a liberal arts focus, having the arts and history and philosophy and literature, and exposing young people to the vast resources that enable us to tell a robust human story. So Nannie Helen Burroughs was particularly, I would say, ahead of her time in understanding that young people needed both, that it wasn't an either or conversation, but in fact, a both and, because ultimately the goal is to cultivate people who can be contributors to their society and to ensure that they are undergirded with the resources, with the inputs that would enable them to be able to do that.
Mm-hmm. That's very helpful. Yeah. So you see her as kind of a bridge figure, someone who's holding on to two sides of a good thing that have been opposed to each other in some way, unhelpfully or artificially. You've used the term yourself, kind of shifting a little bit from Dr. Burroughs to Dr. Graves, and a time shift as well. But you've used the term tyranny of metrics, describing our current educational landscape. And approaches. And that's a, you know, fairly rhetorically, you know, aggressive phrase, the tyranny of metrics, kind of criticizing something pretty strongly. I'm wondering if you would connect in the history of education, you know, on your own part. Do you feel like we've gotten off track with some of the elements of, you know, that was a debate you referenced between Booker T. Washington and W.E.B. Du Bois within the community, you know, the world of African American educators, an intense and substantial debate that took place. But it was also related to, you know, a larger debate that was taking place across the United States and has been ongoing, really, even to the present day. Do you feel that we've kind of lost that balance in some way in our educational approach more generally in the United States today? And how would you describe the ways in which we might have gotten off track and succumbed to a tyranny of metrics?
Yeah. So when I say, I just want to be clear. I understand, and I've been trained to understand, that there is a place for measurement in education, because you have to be able to measure change, and you have to do that. We do that quantitatively, both quantitatively and qualitatively. And of course, measurement has its place because it's connected to our funding models in education, right? The allocation of resources are based upon those primarily quantitative metrics. I think what becomes dangerous is when there's an over-reliance on metrics as indicative of actual human growth and progress, right? So for instance, that's like standardized testing. I don't particularly believe or personally believe in standardized testing because it doesn't tell you anything, right? It can tell you how well a student did on a test, but it doesn't actually say anything about what the student actually knows. And, you know, I've never had a student say, you know what, Dr. Graves, that test really changed my life. Nobody says that, right? They talk about the people and the experiences that changed their lives. Also, when it comes to kind of this over-reliance on measurement, and again, I there's a balance, right? There is a place for measurement. So I'm talking about this in the extreme sense, but it really creates a sense of anxiety around the learning experience that's just not conducive. I experience this every semester. Students are always incredibly nervous about grades and, oh my gosh, I'm late. I have to turn this in 1 minute late. Am I going to be docked 50 points for it? And I'm like, what does that have to do with the actual learning experience, right? And so it just creates an overwhelming amount of anxiety around learning, that so that the preoccupation becomes the grade I'm receiving, how am I going to be tested on this, as opposed to the actual experience or knowledge cultivation that we want students to experience. So in a lot of ways, when we think about metrics in education, metrics has become about measuring information transmission as opposed to character formation, right? And that's when it becomes, for me, that's where we lean into it. And I know it's a provocative phrase, the tyranny of metrics. There's actually a book on it, in fact. But when we are overly invested in measuring information transmission as opposed to character formation, I think for me, that's particularly problematic. And I think it's problematic to cultivate people who believe that their worth can be reduced to a metric, right? Or all of what they know can be summarized in a number. I can tell you there were plenty of tests I failed as a student, right? And just kind of the psychological impact it has on you. So for instance, I mean, even personally, I don't give tests in my courses, right? I like for students to do self-assessments, peer assessments, things like that, just to kind of take the pressure out of the learning environment, because I want them to focus on the experience they're having and not whether or not I'm going to dock them 50 points for turning something in 15 minutes late.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, I hear you talking about student formation, character formation, and how the experience of the students is actually, students are distracted from the most important things that are supposed to be happening for them in the educational life. And they're distracted, and we have we have a course on assessment on Classical U, and it talks about one of the lectures by Dr. Brian Williams is about the history of assessment, and it's really kind of a sad history. And but he's emphasizing how we've gone from models where there was, you know, like the Oxford University tutor model, where there's a lot of it's sort of a, in Christian terms, it's like discipleship, you know, where it's relational, it's based on the teacher inspiring the student, the subject matter inspiring the student and causing growth and flourishing and development. Whereas what we have is a very kind of superficial, shallow system that terrorizes and distracts students and causes them to care. It trains them actually, right, to care more about certain fairly superficial measures of success and think, I'm a successful person potentially because they've scored 100 three times in a row. Whereas, you know, are they thinking about their classmates' learning experiences? Are they self-reflecting, you know, on some of the most significant character issues that they could be considering in light of what they're studying? I really appreciate what you're saying. You mentioned a book. Is there a title or author that you could recommend?
Yeah, I believe it. The book is actually called The Tyranny of Metrics. I can't remember the name of the author now, but if listeners type that in, yeah.
I'll have to look that up. Yeah, we'll link, obviously, to your book on Nanny Helen Burroughs, and we try to sort of keep track of recommendations from our guests as well. So we'll look that up. Thank you. In the history, you know, of education, who are some of your heroes? Who inspires you? Obviously, Dr. Burroughs is one of your heroes, but I'm sure you have a list. What are some going back across? As classical educators, we tend to love to include, all of history and go back in time and kind of keep everybody in view. But who are some of your heroes? Who would you point to in the history of education as exemplars?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, there's a long list, so I'll keep it short. I would say primarily, and I have to, you know, say this certainly because I am of the Christian faith, but Jesus Christ certainly is for me the premier teacher invested in really transformational leadership, because Christ had the ability to make complex topics simple. And I think that's a lesson that every teacher ought to take. Great teaching is not about how complicated you can make a subject. Great teaching is about how simple. If the student feels like, man, this is easy, that's not a bad thing, right? Like, people think that that easy somehow means there's less rigor. My responsibility as a teacher, I've taught philosophy, et cetera, is how do I make this digestible for students? How do I ensure that they can absorb this so that the content is not intimidating, right? The whole idea that subjects in these disciplines have to be intimidating, I think, is the wrong orientation when we think about education. So Jesus Christ, primarily because he had the ability to make complex topics simple, and he reached people at their level so that they could absorb what he was sharing into their own lives. Also, I think Socrates, of course, the whole idea of learning through questions and answers. I tell my graduate students all the time, I teach both undergrads and graduate students. And what I've observed with my graduate students is that, you know, by the time you're in graduate school, you've been conditioned through the school system on how you are supposed to do school. And a lot of times with, I see this with my undergrads too, but they're always interested in giving me the right answer. And for me, I'm like, don't focus on giving me the right answer. I'm trying to help you think about how to arrive or how to ask the right question that would lead you to the next level of insight. So what's the difference between an answer and insight? An answer is a piece of information. It's a fact. But insight is a moment of clarity. Insight is when you're able to make connections between disparate parts. So in many ways, just giving an answer is finite. What I'm interested in as a shaper, as a cultivator, as an educator, is to help students arrive at the next level of insight. Because insight is the aggregate weight of information. It is the settled wisdom. right? So that's where, as an educator, that's always my goal, to help students arrive at the next level of insight, to help them think through complex issues rather than trying to ensure that you satisfy my professorial ego by giving me the right answer, right? Like that's not what this is about. So Socrates in the example is quite powerful in terms of the Q&A method and learning through. And Green, of course, we discussed Nanny Helen Burroughs, but there's a lesser known figure, a woman by the name of Vivian Ayers Allen, who was actually the mother of Felicia Rashad. We know Felicia Rashad from The Cosby Show. And she's the mother of Debbie Allen. So both Felicia Rashad and Debbie Allen are extraordinary performers and artists, if you will. But Vivian Ayers Allen, she's a poet Pulitzer Prize winner, I believe. She has this thing about opening students up, right? That the purpose of education is to open students up and allow them to determine the difference that it makes in them. And so really, we were talking about metrics and things like that earlier. Really, that's kind of an open-ended outcome. The greatest learning outcome is for students to be able to determine the difference that the learning makes in them. And then finally, this is a random one, Miss Frizzle from the Magic School Bus, right? I think I'm probably telling my age here. You can tell I grew up in the 90s, but I wanted to be Miss Frizzle from the Magic School Bus, although she was a cartoon. But I mean, Miss Frizzle was just a teacher extraordinaire. As a matter of fact, I teach every year a course on history and philosophy of education, and I actually have my students watch episodes of the Magic School Bus. But literally, I mean, Miss Frizzle was an extraordinary teacher. I loved her teaching style. I mean, the way that she was able to take students on these powerful journeys of discovery, mm-hmm. right? Because that's what learning is about. Learning is the action. Education is the outcome, right? Mm-hmm. Education mm-hmm. is what happens after learning has settled in a person, and the person has to now use or apply that information in their life somehow. But I love the Magic School Bus because Miss Frizzle took her students on powerful journeys of discovery. I mean, the way that they would dive into different incredible environments, if you will, the way she challenged them to make connections between what they were experiencing and the real world was just incredible. So I would say Jesus Christ, Socrates, of course, Nanny Helen Burroughs, Vivian Ayers Allen, and then, of course, Miss Frizzle from the Magic School Bus.
What's a good resource for Vivian Ayers Allen?
Yeah, you know what? That's a great question. Someone really should write a book one day. Maybe I'll have to do that. I think you've given me another project, right?
All right.
So, YouTube, you can type in Vivian Ayers Allen. If you watch interviews of Felicia Rashad and Debbie Allen, they're always talking about the educational impact that their mother had. On their lives, and it comes at no surprise that both of them are in the arts, right? And they use the arts as a powerful educational tool. So yeah, I mean, YouTube, and she's still living as of the date of this interview. She's 100. She may be 100 or 101. So she's still here. Yeah.
Beautiful. Thank you. So you mentioned that image of opening students up, allowing students to really participate in, what education is accomplishing for them. But the teacher's role, it sounds like, is primarily to help the students to be comfortable, to be curious, right, to have wonder, and to open up. That's beautiful. What are some activities or even evaluative, methods that help rather than hinder in this kind of objective?
Yeah. So certainly as a trained educator, we have to have our perfectly stated learning outcomes, right? So I have those. But I also have what I call an open-ended learning outcome, where leaning on Vivian Ayers Allen philosophy of opening students up and letting them determine the difference that it makes in them. Every semester I have, or as a just part of my the educational experience that students have with me, I allow them to reflect throughout the semester on the difference that the content has made in their own lives. And I do that very simply. Like, it doesn't have to be overly complicated, because I think you have the explicitly stated learning outcomes, right? Which is what we expect and hope and want students to be able to accomplish. But then you have what students actually learn, right? Yep. So you have what's stated about what's expected, but then you have what the human being has actually gleaned from that experience.
Yeah.
And so I ask a simple question every week. You know, I'll state this, my learning, an open-ended learning outcome for me means that students will learn that after this lesson, students will learn something different that they did not know before. And the way that you measure that, I ask students, I say, answer, you know, respond to this prompt. Before this lesson, I used to think. After this lesson, now I think. And when you ask that question, you actually get to what the student actually gleaned. And it might be totally different from what the stated learning outcome was. Now, does that mean it's wrong? No, because learning occurred. Learning happened, right? Like that's the joy of discovery and the joy of learning. I think, you know, in education, we are trained kind of in this linear fashion. And we understand that there has to be alignment, but learning can be circuitous, right? Something there, learning is a circuitous journey. And so it's always interesting when I have students answer that question, before this lesson, I used to think, after this lesson, now I think, because that's how you actually see what they got out of that. And, you know, a lot of times it may not be, you know, they were able to enumerate the three factors that led up to World War II or whatever. I mean, you know, they may be able to do that, but it's interesting to see the change that happens in their character. Like, I'll have students say, after this lesson, I went and talked to my mother about A, B, C, or D. After this lesson, I shared, for instance, I teach a religion. One of the courses I teach is actually a religion course. So I'm on two sides of the house. I'm in the humanities and I'm in the social sciences. So on the humanities side, I teach a religion course. And more important than the student saying to me, I can enumerate all of the names of the patristic fathers, if you will, or the early church fathers, I love to see when they say, after this lesson, I went and showed my little brother this video of whatever. I went and talked about this with my family. That's actually education, right? That's more than information transmission. That's character formation now. So anyway, I'll stop rambling, but I really lean into, I mean, I have my stated learning outcomes for the purposes of, like, I've served on accreditation committees and peer reviews, and I understand all of that. And, you know, you have to make sure stuff is aligned. But I think the greatest learning outcome when it comes to education is that are the open-ended experiences and allowing students to define and to articulate the difference that particular intervention or engagement or lesson made in them.
Yeah. I mean, I'm hearing a strong element in there of just being aware of your students as a teacher, you know, so that you're learning about them, and that's going to shape and inform how you continue to deliver, you know, lessons in the future. Just being aware of what are they actually doing with this, and how are they understanding how they're changing as a result.
Absolutely.
Yeah, wonderful. Yeah, ramble on. That's what you're here for. So the you know, as classical educators, where I work, we tend to get a little bit maybe overboard in terms of worrying about the loss of the liberal arts, you know, and kind of reductions in fine arts elements in our schools, and cuts, you know, cuts to the fine arts and to the liberal arts curricularly, and so on and so forth. So I try not to be too alarmist, you know, but at the same time, I do think we're in a period of time where kind of factory model has increasingly predominated, and we've lost sight of the whole person. And I do think that some advocacy, you know, is in order. How do you, you know, both, I guess I'm asking two questions in one here. One is, to what extent would you say that we do have, you know, a problem in terms of a loss of, an imbalance, or, some real losses to be addressed? And then how do you go about advocating, insofar as there is an issue? What are some of the most effective ways you've found to advocate for the liberal arts and the fine arts?
Yeah. So I think when you look at our current environment, I think, you know, you may be hinting at some of the decreases or cuts that we see in liberal arts or humanities education versus STEM, right? And I think there's a couple of answers to that. The first one is, we live in a technology-driven era, if you will, and there's a growing perception that STEM skills are more valuable, particularly when you look at the market, that STEM skills are more valuable and more marketable as opposed to liberal arts degrees. So I think just kind of our natural progression toward this into a technology dominant era, as opposed to a more human centered era, is a perspective explanation to that. Also, I think from a global positioning angle in the U.S., our global positioning is important. When you reflect back on the Cold War and the space race, and the U.S. and the Soviet Union, and, you know, when the Soviet Union launched Sputnik in 57, you know, the U.S. response was to pass the National Defense Education Act, yeah, where education now becomes
a weapon.
Or it becomes a defense and a national security priority, right?
Yeah, yeah,
so,
yeah.
Because again, it's connected to our global positioning, and in our current geopolitical environment, our ability to compete with China, who produce China produces just an extraordinary and incredible droves of STEM professionals, right? So again, of particular importance when we think about the U.S. global positionings, how do we ensure that we can compete and maintain dominance on the world stage, if you will? So that's a geopolitical answer. I also think just in time, when you think about times of economic constraint, the humanities are always seen as expendable, but because the question is, what can you do with an English degree, right? What can you do with a history degree? What can you do with a philosophy degree? And really, that is short-term thinking, because it's really about the holistic development of the whole person and creating fulfilled human beings, despite the particular, you know, disciplinary pathway that they choose. But I think we have to question ourselves, right? What good is it to have a generation of people who can code but don't have empathy? What good is it to have a generation of people that can build incredible software, right? Who can engineer incredible innovations, but don't have the ability to connect on a human level, right? Because even that human centeredness is important when you talk about technology design, right? And how do we ensure that the human remains predominant even in the midst of kind of this vast technological explosion? So I think there's a couple of answers to that. And think in terms of, how do we advocate for the importance of the liberal arts in today's environment? I think we have to think about what can happen if we neglect the humanities. Like I just mentioned, you know, a generation of people who have these extraordinary technology skills, but lack kind of the basic human skills of empathy, courage, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
Commitment, like kind of these things that can't be touched, but they can be cultivated in a person. Yeah. You can't touch courage. You can't touch commitment. You can't touch empathy, but those values can be cultivated. So I think we have to think about what happens if we don't maintain an investment in the humanities and the liberal arts. I mean, emotional intelligence, you can't touch emotional intelligence, but it is something that has to be cultivated in people. So I think for me, it's not a STEM versus humanities conversation, because both are important. It's about how do we ensure that both areas, both STEM and the humanities and liberal arts, are in dialogue, and that we invest in both of those areas, if you will, because at the end of the day, it's about the cultivation of better human beings. For me, there's only one real purpose of education, and the purpose of education is to create better humans, is to support the development of better humans. So both are important to the conversation.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I know you're a philosopher as well, and I'm tempted to, you know, move in some anthropology direction, you know, what is a human being, but there's some profound issues you're touching on there. I'm going to shift though, in a slightly different direction. I've heard you lecture on, both, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. And, his wife, Coretta Scott King, who both were educators in their own rights with their own, you know, approaches and philosophies. You mentioned, specifically with, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., that he did not throw anybody out. Just that his was an expansive kind of view of human history and an inclusive kind of view of human history, where he wanted his students to encounter and engage with even people that he would have seen substantial problems with. And I feel like that's kind of another a somewhat separate set of problems that we're faced with in the current landscape as educators, trying to cultivate a wholeness of humanity in ourselves and our students, is this kind of constant, you know, separating off into various categories and then a lack of engagement and exposure and sort of charity and empathy at one level. Am I hearing your phrase right? And how would you speak to what we could learn, you know, here? I mean, there's so many things. And when you bring up, figures such as Martin Luther King Jr. and Coretta Scott King, but that we could learn. But in this regard, what are some examples as well, you know, of how he did that?
Sure. Absolutely. When you look at Martin Luther King Jr.'s intellectual journey, correct. He was ecumenical in his, in how he gleaned from various sources. Also, I think people have to remember that Dr. King was first and foremost a pastor. And so redemption, grace, and mercy are central to his ethic and the edict, if you will, under which he conducted his life. And so as an example, there was a philosopher, Dr. King was influenced by G.W.F. Hegel, who was a philosopher. He was particularly influenced by Hegel's dialectic. And so dialectic is just a fancy way to say that change or progress or growth comes through struggle. So, but Hegel, as many folks in the Africana philosophy world may recognize, Hegel was quite problematic in some of his ideas as it relates to Africa and African descended people. In fact, Hegel said, Africa is no historical part of the world. It has no It has no movement of development to exhibit. He goes on to say, what we properly understand by Africa is the unhistorical, undeveloped spirit. So literally, Hegel is saying that Africa has no history. It literally exists outside of human history. That goes back to the anthropological question of, or the philosophical anthropological question around what is man, right? And so Hegel sees Africa and African descended people, of course, by extension, as outside of the realm of human history, that there's nothing there that impacts how man has developed. So what's interesting, though, when I say Dr. King didn't throw people away, is that in our current environment, it would be easy to cancel Hegel, right? And just say he was racist, he said this, you know, he believed that Black folks were outside of the realm of human history, so we're going to throw away his entire philosophical system. That's not how Dr. King functioned as an intellectual. He was able to, as my grandma might say, eat the meat and leave the bones, if you will. So he was able to see goodness and truth in diverse places, right? But also acknowledge where there may have been philosophical or ideological problems. And I think when we think about education, it's about the cultivation of holistic human beings who understand how to look at different sources and find truth. And what you see really in both Dr. King and in Mrs. King's life is a search for truth. I mean, you look at the philosophy and methodology of nonviolence. Dr. King talks about it. He got his inspiration from Jesus, but he got his technique from Gandhi. There were, you know, scholars have recognized some problematic things that Gandhi said during his life, right? But it doesn't mean that you throw the person away. And I think even when you think about the Christian tradition, of which both Dr. King and Mrs. King were a part, they you don't, and that's in alignment with the philosophy of nonviolence as well, you don't throw people away. There may be issues that are problematic and we can address those, but you don't throw the human being away. Because as long as that human being lives, as long as that person is existing, there is room and opportunity for redemption. I mean, I know this is not a religious podcast, but that's the entire kind of modus operandi of Jesus Christ, if you will, that as long as that human being has breath, there is room and opportunity for redemption.
Yeah. Well, I mean, classical educators include a lot of faith-based, you know, Christian. There are Muslim and Jewish educators as well that are engaging in writing specifically on the topic of classical education. So it includes public charter, you know, secular, if you will, as well as faith-based and explicitly Christian and religious. So, yeah, I appreciate that. The you know, some of the sort of canceling, to use a word that I don't think is all that helpful, because it's, you know, when you get into the culture war territory and stuff, it just everything's gets a little bit unhelpfully escalated and distracting. But some of the changes in curriculum that are, you know, particularly bothersome or troubling to classical educators tend to be, you know, some of the very traditional texts and some of the older texts, you know, even Homer, Homer's Odyssey, and, you know, you've referenced Socrates and several times already. But I know that, you know, King was very much, his references to classical literature throughout his corpus is just phenomenal. I mean, he was a reader of the classics. I can't imagine he would have, approved of this sort of, I mean, it's very much in line with what you were just describing.
Yeah.
But specifically with the classics, how would you describe his relationship there and what he might have to say to our time?
Yeah, absolutely. King was a thinker, and King was like I mentioned earlier, Dr. King was primarily a pastor. In fact, that's what he wanted to be. You know, all he wanted to be was a great pastor. But academically, he really was a scholar, a thinker, a philosopher of sorts. And he was interested and committed to the life of the mind. And for, and so for him, that meant being able to engage with different sources, going on incredible journeys of discovery that allowed him to access people in different parts of the world, philosophies in different parts of the world. And what it did for him is that it gave him an incredible reference bank. The reason why Dr. King was an incredible orator was because he was a great and a deep reader. And I'm not sure if people always understand how that relationship works. In fact, when you look at many of the great orators in human history, one thing they have in common is that they were great readers. And when I say great and deep readers, I'm using those words specifically because there is such a thing as narrow reading. Narrow reading is when you only read the things that you like, and when you only read, you know, a single genre, and there's no diversity in the sources that one has access to. So Dr. King's oratory and his ability to be particularly persuasive, but to speak different languages at one time to many people. I say Dr. King was multilingual. So not in the traditional sense. I mean, he was multilingual in the sense that, like, I mean, if you look at the I Have a Dream speech, it's a perfect example. He pulled from the Bible and scriptures. He pulled from great American documents. He pulled from historical experiences. So that in that one speech, it is an extraordinary example of a man who was multilingual in the sense that he's able to speak to many diverse audiences of people at the same time, right? So folks in the audience who may have been more oriented to political history, or those, you know, and with the African Americans in the audience, you know, folks from different walks of life in the audiences. In that one speech, he's able to speak to everybody at the same time. But that's only possible if you read widely and if you read deeply. If you are a narrow reader and you cancel certain things out of your literary diet, then, you know, one's oratory, one's the way that one shows up in life is going to be particularly reflective on of that. When you think about the difference between Dr. King and Mrs. King, now Dr. King, as I said, he's a pastor. Academically, he's a philosopher and a scholar. Her educational philosophy, in fact, emphasized or put a greater emphasis on the arts as a vehicle for social transformation. A lot of people don't know that Coretta Scott King was an artist. She was a singer, and she wanted to be a concert singer. In fact, she was on her way to doing that before Dr. King came and, you know, changed her plans. But she was, you know, well on her way to becoming a concert artist. So she really put a lot of emphasis on the arts as a vehicle for public education, if you will. She emphasized, as you see, during the civil rights movement, she put on what were called freedom concerts, which kind of narrated the story of the movement. So she saw music and poetry and storytelling as nourishment for the human spirit, but also vital modes for expressing the human experience. And she saw it as a source of healing for people. So whereas Dr. King is particularly academic in his approach, you know, Mrs. King also was a wide reader and had a wide reference bank. But it's beautiful to see how in their partnership, she was able to focus on the arts and to bring that to the world. So anyway, I'll stop rambling about that. But both just incredibly gifted individuals who were able to use their genius and express their genius in different ways as it relates to education.
Yeah, I mean, what a team! You know, that pairing is an incredibly dynamic way to communicate. It's like the dream team as far as communicating and getting a message out and encouraging and supporting people. And also, I mean, I'm hearing substantial kind of prophetic challenges, you know, from both of those approaches or emphases to our current, you know, situation and the temptations to, you know, cut the fine arts when the budgets are tight. It sounds like Mrs. King, you know, would have some concerns in that
regard. Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah. Good. The history of education in the United States is a topic of kind of perpetual interest and concern to my audience specifically. And you've referenced some really helpful ways, lenses, you know, for thinking about that in terms of the Cold War and kind of geopolitical factors. I'm wondering as well about the if you'd have any thoughts on the origins of specifically the factory model. You know, I think there was some influence of Prussian educational system, and some of that is certainly involved in the W.E.B. Du Bois and Booker T. Washington debate. Would you have any insight into some of that American history and what kind of some of the pulls or attractions were that have shaped where we're at today?
Sure. So when you look at the history of education has always been connected, or when you look at educational leaders, has been connected to what the nation needed, even coming out of the Revolutionary War. You have Thomas Jefferson, who is a proponent of public education, or, you know, what he called the general diffusion of knowledge, and how do we cultivate a citizenry. But also, for most of its history, or for early history, the United States, particularly when you look at the South, has been an agrarian society. And so the development of education coincided, again, with the needs of the nation, if you will, in terms of being, and particularly in the South, an agrarian society. So going to school during particular months, and then you're off during these months. All right. So we're still kind of operating in that vein. And I think, you know, there's opportunity to rethink. And I think, you know, folks have been doing it, because you have year-round schools, charter school. I mean, you have a lot of different formations of schooling, which is, of course, different from schooling is the infrastructure, and learning is what happens inside of that infrastructure, and then education is the outcome. But I think there's room to re-envision what dynamic education looks like, right? We are a technology-based, we're a knowledge-driven society. So, you know, we're not predominantly agrarian terms, you know, the vast majority of folks are not working on farms anymore. So I think there's opportunity to rethink schools. For instance, I think even when you look at higher ed in the 16-week model, a semester of 16 weeks is just, I think there's opportunity to rethink that. I know from experience, after week 8, students are tuned out. They're like, okay, I'm over it. Let me just get through this so we can finish this out. So I think there's opportunity to re-envision what effective education looks like. There was a school in Canada, which doesn't exist. I think it closed recently, but their model was very interesting. They reduced the number of classes that students had to take at one time, and then they shortened the time span, because particularly with undergraduates, what I recognize, or I would have students who were taking, you know, between 15 and 21 credits a semester. You're talking about, you know, 21 credits can be 7 classes. I mean, just the cognitive load of that doesn't make sense, right? And then these are six, you know, they would be in 16-week class. So you have 7 classes, 16 weeks long. I mean, there's no way that is healthy from a cognitive or from a learning perspective. So this particular university, I believe it was called Quest University. I think students only took maybe 1 or 2 classes at a time, and they were like 3 or 4 weeks or something like that. But the essence of what I'm saying is that they switched up the model so that they could have a greater potentiality for student for student success. So I definitely think we have to rethink what education looks like and understand that students are not going to get 100% of everything they need in a class, right? Mm-hmm. That's not the purpose. The purpose is to light a spark, if you will, to light a flame that they can carry themselves.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've heard you reference a few times to kind of the long game, and that education is a little too focused on short-term objectives rather than long-term objectives.
Yeah. We have to if I can just say this, we have to jailbreak the class. I believe we have to jailbreak the classroom. Let me just share this story. And in teaching, particularly when I was on campus on a daily basis, I had a note on my syllabus that said, your experience is subject to change based upon the discretion of the instructor, right? Because you have these students going back to the factory conversations we were talking about, where everybody's sitting in these rows and, you know, it's the 40-minute. I would literally stop in the middle of class and be like, all right, let's go outside. And we would have class outside on the grass. We would have class in the hallway. I mean, literally, mm-hmm. I would do that. I'm like, you know, let's go in the hallway and have class. So, and they're like, what? But I guarantee you, they never forgot it, right? Yep. They will forget the content. They will forget they may forget the lessons, but they will never forget the human being who invested in them. And mm-hmm. they'll never forget how they felt and the experience they had in that classroom. So anyway, I just think there's ample opportunity, particularly in this age of innovation, to jailbreak the classroom. All right. Mm-hmm. So that's my little aside.
No, that's good. You know, the long-term kind of view, and the view that includes a complete, you know, picture of the past, that isn't trying to just myopically focus on, you know, how many boxes can I check, how many credits, you know, that I think the factory model comes in when students are taking, you know, 7 classes at a time. It's because it's all about production quotas, right? You know, right. To use factory terms, like they think their success in school means, you know, A, what's my GPA, and B, how many credits did I earn? And it's all in these kind of pseudo monetary or factory production kind of categories of thought. And you're trying to jailbreak the classroom. It sounds like, you know, particularly with older students, you're fighting against their own formation, you know, things that they've been missing, misshaped in through even their younger, K-12 experience. Yeah. They've been taught that school is something that's shallower than it's really supposed to be. You know, it feels like swimming upstream, you know, in so many different ways, the social, you know, settings, the distraction of, you know, social media, the career pressures that we face, you know, even our kind of financial system, the way in which children are shaped in their school experience all kind of works against the sort of classroom that I hear you trying to provide to your students as teachers, you know, just taking it away from that big, you know, cause it gets discouraging. You start sounding very reactionary or, you know, dramatic, in the big picture, but in the classroom, you've just described a few very practical, simple things you do to bring a kind of humanity back into the teacher-student subject, you know, dynamic of what you're studying and who you're studying it together with. I guess I'm looking for more examples, you know, of assignments, activities, practical things teachers can do, or even stepping out, you know, how do we stay refreshed as educators? You know, what are some resources that you might point us to encourage us in humanizing our teaching labors?
Yeah, absolutely. I think one is for teachers understanding that your students are people. They're little people. Well, if you're in, you know, K-12, they're little people. Undergrad, they're bigger people. And then graduate, they're real grown people. But
but they're always people.
But they're people, right? So you're helping to shape people and not mm-hmm. widgets, not people, not thing. Widgets just run a set of automated processes. Right. And that's not what people do. People interact. People care. People feel. So understanding your students as people, also broadening our definition of success beyond test scores. There are plenty of tests that I failed, plenty of tests that I passed. I don't remember anything from any of the tests that I and never learned anything from any of the tests that I took. And so understanding that the metrics of success can't be reduced to test scores. And, mm-hmm. you know, teachers have a, particularly in the K-12 system, have a particular, I think, anxiety around this because teacher evaluations are based on student grades and test scores and things like that. So it's about, you know, cultivating well-rounded human beings, also cultivating kind of these interdisciplinary capacities that students need. I am a person who is interdisciplinary by default. I love philosophy. I love anthropology. I love history. I love technology, right? And so I think it's important that we begin to cultivate these interdisciplinary capacities because the problems we face are interdisciplinary, right? And we need people who can think across different domains. You may not be an expert, but particularly, and this is an interesting leadership tip as well, but if you have the ability to ask the right question, I am not an expert in statistics, but I know enough about it to ask the right question so that, you know, so that I'm not hoodwinked or bamboozled in, you know, if I'm in a meeting or something like that and somebody's rattling off statistics, I at least know enough to be able to ask questions about it. So also when I think about schools and kind of what can be done to strengthen schools in our nation, I did a panel recently at the Arizona State University and Global Silicon Valley Summit talking about school safety and ensuring that schools have what they need from an infrastructure standpoint, from a tech standpoint, from a content standpoint to ensure safety across all levels. And then lastly, I think about strengthening schools. I think about paying teachers a livable wage. It is an absolute shame that teachers are among some of the lowest paid professionals in our society. I mean, the people who are responsible for cultivating the brains of the next generation are among some of the least paid folks in our society. And this is interesting in comparison to what you see in other nations, right? Just look at what they pay teachers in Luxembourg, you know? So I think there's work to be done to show that as a nation that we really value education as a transformative force and ensure that the folks that are responsible for cultivating young people have access to the resources that they need to continue to do the great jobs that they're doing.
Yeah, well, you're just stacking up the challenges here. I'll ask one more question, and we'll close with this one. It is slightly off script, but I'm curious as I hear your passion and love for interdisciplinary studies and you know, the humanities, but not exclusively. You know, you're in the social sciences, and you can ask the right questions about statistics and so on and so forth. But where did your own, you know, what were some of the ways in which you were shaped and formed in these loves that are somewhat, they're countercultural? I mean, you know, it doesn't come kind of from the air that we breathe in this day and age to be interdisciplinary, to love philosophy and religion and, you know, the sciences all at the same time. So where did some of that come from for you personally?
Yeah, well, you know, I'm the product of great parents. And for me, both of my parents were involved in the world of learning. And as a young person, as I was introduced to learning before I was introduced to school. I remember I did a survey one time in one of my classes, and I asked students, do you love school or do you hate school? And if you hate school, at what point did you start hating it? And a lot of what you see is around like that middle school, high school area where kids are just like, I hate this. So because they're in a system at that point. So for me, in my early cultivation, I was introduced to learning. So for me, school was a job because I learned at home, like learning and watching. My mother introduced us to National Geographic. My father introduced us to tech stuff and to design. And so I had those inputs as a young person. So I didn't see education or learning in these very narrow ways. I could watch National Geographic with my mother, and then I could watch or listen to NPR with my father, right? Listen to talk radio, look at history documentaries with my father. So my parents were surrounded us with an incredible amount of inputs that allowed us to be creative, because that's what creativity is. The key to creativity is to surround oneself with a lot of inputs, because it gives you then a greater reference bank from which you can pull to be innovative and to be ingenious, if you will. So I would say for me, I was introduced to learning before I was introduced to school. And then when I got to school, I was like, you know, it became just something I had to get through, because I was excited to get home to read the books my mom had bought, or, you know, my mother found a new documentary on cheetahs, you know, with National Geographic. And so I was excited about those things, and school became like, oh my gosh, here we go. And there was a sense of anxiety as a young person, because I'm like, okay, if I don't know this, I'm going to be tested on it next week. And if I fail the test, and I'm going to get a bad grade in this class and on my report card, you know. Now, I mean, granted, I was a good student, but I've just always been interested in learning. And so even today, my approach to education is around, how do we cultivate a love for learning in students? That's why in my classes, I don't always, when I was on campus, I didn't always sit in the classroom. I would teach outside. I would teach in the hallway. We would go on walks. If I felt like, you know, the students were looking sleepy that day, I said, all right, let's go on a walk. And I would walk down the hallway and we would talk, because that's education, right? And you have to, students have to understand that learning can happen anywhere. Michael Crow recently said at the ASU GSV conference, he talked about how learning should be like eating, right? It's something that you do. It doesn't have to be a programmed thing where you're sitting down and now it's time to listen. I mean, it can be that can be a part of it, but that's not the dynamic nature of what the life of the mind and what learning is. So for me, I was introduced to learning before I was introduced to school.
Yeah. So you came to realize that learning was a basic human activity, is a basic part of human life. And you're trying to bring some of the insights that you received in your home to your students in the classroom, it sounds like, in your own work as an educator.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, that's beautiful. Thank you. It's been absolutely wonderful to get a little more time with you and to hear your passion and your love for your students and for all areas of learning. So thanks so much, Dr. Graves.
Absolutely. Thank you.
You've been listening to Classical U's podcast. Thank you for tuning in. We release podcast episodes once a month with our presenters. Please also check out our live learning events, webinars, in collaboration with Scholae Academy and Scholae Communities.